Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum. Connect your intellect. You can find out more about our organization and events online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Josh McHugh, CEO of Attention Span Media and President of Inforum's Board of Directors, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's event, Burning Man, the story behind Black Rock City, with the founder of Burning Man, Larry Harvey. Larry has been at the helm of Burning Man from day one on Baker Beach here in town, and has helped to make Burning Man into what it is today, an experiment in temporary community dedicated to radical self-expression and self-reliance, inviting its citizens to express themselves in ways that are often a dramatic departure from their daily lives. Burning Man has since extended its roots beyond Black Rock City, and we'll talk about that, not just regionally, but internationally as well. We'll hear a bunch more about the backstory and where the organization is headed. And let's get into it. So, Larry.
Yes.
I've heard a few different stories about why Burning Man started, and a few different stories about what you burned and who it represented, or what it represented. Can you talk about that and just set the record straight
once and for all? There are a few myths, and myths are useful things in certain ways. A myth speaks to our intuition that the causes of things are contained in their germ, in their origin. And so there's always been a call, for stories about the inception. And I think it's a valid way to look at it. I incautiously told a journalist for Outside Magazine years ago that it coincided with the anniversary of a broken love affair. And that story's gone around the globe now. And I still tell that story when I'm in the mood. I got tired of telling it a while back and started saying that I probably said this last time I was here. I started claiming it was my I heard then it was my ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend, so then I contributed the thought that maybe it was my old girlfriend's lawyer. But that isn't true. And there are lots of precedents for it, you know. It emerged out of San Francisco's bohemian culture, which, you know, has always characterized this city. Mm-hmm. The values that animated us in starting out were definitely artistic and certainly consonant with everything we know about bohemia. And a creative collaboration, gift-giving. Anyone who's ever known an artist, a painter, you really become friends with a painter. It's not uncommon to be sitting around their studio and if they detect that you're looking at something frequently, they'll ask you if you like it, and you say, oh, yeah, I just love it. And it's not uncommon for them to, unless, of course, there are agents in the room, to say, here, take it. Because they've gone on to create new gifts with their gifts, and so they're not so attached, to their product or their labor, and so
they have no problem setting it on fire.
Oh well, building something and setting it on fire is a classic boho move, really. So it has something to do with that, and you can trace it all the way back to the Beats if you want to, and you can trace it back to the 49ers, who would all, on their way over in ships, most of them came by, you know, sailed to San Francisco, and on the trip, they'd acquire a nickname, just like people in the service will acquire nicknames, you know, by the time they reach the combat zone, and the miners, good Lord, in the old days in this city, the miners would get excited about something, an opera singer, something, and they'd start parading down Market Street with, you know, at the drop of a hat. You know, that's the city. That's why so many people come to live here, because they can be here as they can invent themselves here, and they can create themselves here. And, you know, San Francisco started out as a precociously civilized place in the middle of in the Wild West, and out in the desert, you know, there's signs that go in mm-hmm. the city along the roadway, and the trope at the very beginning is "Welcome to the vacant heart of the Wild West,"
Well, before we get up to the desert, though. Let's start.
I can
with
tell you a few more origin stories. I've got about five or seven of them. No, we'll move on. But.
Well, getting back to that first burn at Baker Beach. How many people were there?
Oh, about eight.
Eight.
I'm guessing.
Okay. How about the next year?
Oh, it would have been double that. Maybe a little more than double.
Okay. How many years till you had
then it started more than doubling until the last year we were on the beach, which was 1990. There are guesses at it, but it were a few hundred. Maybe as many as 800 people. It was for us, it was a big crowd.
It's a big crowd.
And that was an interesting year. Because we discovered one of our values as a result of that night on the beach. One of the principles is 10 principles that we use to describe our community is civic responsibility. And that night, representatives of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, their rangers, their police showed up and said we couldn't burn it, and we'd already been on TV, and so we were on their radar, and first they said we couldn't erect it, but you know, these people carried the body parts of this giant down a sand dune, and then they all gathered around, and the guy there who represented the agency had a heart, because they were saying, oh, shame. You know, we waited all year for this. And he's looking at the thing, and it's made like, you know, cabinetry. I mean, you know, it's an elaborately wrought, created thing. It showed intention, and it was, you know, something thoughtfully done. And so they did a deal with us, and they said, okay, you can raise it, but you can't burn it. And we shook hands. And then they promptly left as fast as they could go. And some of my colleagues said, well, okay, that's implicit permission. Let's burn it.
Their leaving was permission.
Yeah. I and my friend Dan Miller had made a bargain. We'd shaken their hands, and so that seemed dishonorable, and indeed, on reflection, it would have been burning our bridges behind us, our men behind us, because then we'd have a rap sheet with the authorities, and we didn't know where we were going. We knew that, you know, we were done on Baker Beach, but so we honored that. But then we were faced with what we never dreamt of. This was a tight little group of mostly carpenters and builders, and they'd worn that man on their shoulders, and they. You know, one of them bled all over it, and we'd never thought of an audience. It was just us doing something. Mm-hmm. It was our radical self-expression, communally organized. It was like what thousands do at the event now in their theme camps. And so we didn't have a megaphone. And there were 800 people, most of whom had nothing invested in it.
Right.
And some of them were just drunks who heard there was a man burning and followed the path of least resistance and rolled down to the shore. And then they began, then it got profane, and they started shouting and demanding he be burned. Burn the bleep. And I heard that my heels dug into the sand. And it turned into a little mob.
So you had to defend the man against people who wanted to burn.
Because sure, they were infused with all this energy, and they'd been deprived of the spectacle
that
they felt had been promised. And the guy attacked me, got his thumbs on my windpipe, and I had to peel him off me. He'd gone to the figure twice with a Bic lighter, and someone had splashed fuel on it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Got a hold of some kerosene, And he did it twice, the third time he did it, I took his arm, and he was blind drunk, and he assaulted me, I went home that night and dreamt of, I don't know, the burning of the Hindenburg, the Dukakis campaign, natural disasters, and I was really shaken by it, because it was such a, here we had this beast on our hands, and we ended up going to the desert. And then suddenly it selected people for commitment. You had to be, you couldn't just, have a drink and go see the show.
So did your
now
assailant
had to go
make
out
it up there?
There and live.
Did
you
he,
know, I'd
was
like
he dedicated?
To believe, I'd like to believe that once he sobered up, and faced himself in the mirror and interrogated his conscience that maybe he went out there. Maybe he's been going all this time. I don't know his name, so I can't say hi to him, But that would be a success story as far as I'm concerned, because we are, as you know, radically inclusive.
But we just didn't
want to include a mob. And then we all went on to build a city. So from that little germ, there's another myth, that little germ of civic responsibility grew a great cosmopolitan city that's ordered for civilized ends.
Well, On that note of the city and building the city and civic responsibility, last year, how many people attended?
What was it? Where's Megan? Megan?
56,000. And news just broke that you've gotten the green light to increase the number.
To 68,000.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I'm curious about is, what do you get from tens of thousands of people that you didn't have when it was just thousands?
What do you get?
What elements are present there? Yeah, because if it weren't getting better as it got bigger, you'd probably just sell fewer tickets or cap it.
Now it's cosmopolitan, and there are people there from all around the world. You get that. We didn't have that. You get enormous diversity. It's just like any real city. You've got, people from all ranges along the socioeconomic spectrum. So you have diversity. I think though people say it, they're afraid it'll get too big, and say it'll be massified, or mainstream, is the word they usually use. But I haven't found that to be the case. What you get we didn't have then. You've got whole villages of people organized, collaborating to survive together in a howling wilderness and survive in high style. I mean, with real amenity. To do that, you have to share resources with others. You have to organize yourselves. And, uh, And in the beginning, you know, well, let's see, that first year, I remember there was sort of a informal urge to maybe make something for the center of the circle of ragged circle of tents that had grown up, and just by an impulse, people just kind of huddling together, and so they'd put a parachute on a single pole at the center, and which of course the first wind destroyed. And because that's the last thing you want to do is use a parachute. They're meant to catch the wind. And early lesson. And so what you have is all this really intelligently meditated productivity on display. And we didn't have that. I don't get sentimental about the old days. In the very early days, one of the chief recreations, well, let's see, what were they? People were goofing off one another, and a group called the Cacophony Society got involved, and they were actually, they did very creative things, but really the amusements were pretty Spartan. You know, being dragged around on a tarp behind a car, that was
big time.
That was big. That was very big.
And it's a little different now.
So the difficulty, you know, I think as things get bigger, they can make you feel smaller. That's true of anything. And someone complained to me about that, and I said, well, Ben, living in this Black Rock city, this place, why don't you organize, and people have done this, organize to do things with your neighbors. Now they have block parties. and organize to do something, say hi to your neighbors, you know.
Get to know.
And get to know them and do something with them, and pretty soon you'll have a neighborhood. And I live in a city, but I have a neighborhood. But that's all depends on your agency, you know, because if you thought that would all be brought, you know, and the thing is, people say, you know, it should be 20,000 or it should be, when they come up with numbers like that, I've gotten a habit when I talk to them and say, hey, what's the first year you went? And they name the year and I know what the population was, mm-hmm. and it's that same number.
That's, 35 is really what
it should
be.
Yeah, 35 is what it should be, and then you raise the gangplank, and it should never get any bigger, and because I like that. And I can go around that city and feel kind of dwarfed by it, you know? Of course, it's replete with invitations to participate. I mean, you know, it's the most intensely interactive community on Earth while it lasts. I think I can actually claim that. And everyone is so welcoming, and all of these theme camps offer you a chance to participate in something. And people open their homes and create something for their fellow citizens.
That's an interesting thing that I realized once I had gone, finally, after hearing about it for years, was that what you hear is that people barter. And what I found was that it's not the case. People aren't, there's not a quid pro quo. It's let me come up with the coolest thing that I can give to somebody else. And as you go through it, other people are doing that for you.
And it needn't be material. It could be gifts of the spirit.
I mean,
you can make yourself a gift, you know, by interacting with people. We said it's about gifts, and then at first people thought that was, then there was a wave of gifts early on, and it was some people in San Francisco, I think, went down to Chinatown and got a bunch of little things, and they turned into what we call matter out of place,
right.
and found their way to the desert floor, and then had to be picked up by somebody. But now I think there's a richer and more nuanced sensibility. And so a gift, it could be anything. Why don't you just start with the idea that you have gifts? Everybody has gifts and things that they feel or they know intuitively they were born to do. They have gifts. And no human being on earth doesn't have some kind of gift. Now, it may be the labor of a lifetime sometimes to find out what they are, but you just do enough stupid things serially because they feel right in some wild sense, then you're probably going to get there sooner than later than if you just looked for a slot and filled it and you know, paid down on your mortgage. And so that is a moral challenge, but then a delight with but one with a delightful result. And I think it's I don't see that flagging in our city, even if it is, will this year be 68,000.
Is there a limit? 500,000?
No, I think that would be a little large. I think that's a political impossibility, first of all. And as you know, there's finally, it funnels down to a county road. We can grow more than 68. We're already looking into that. We've already talked to the BLM about going through a process whereby we examine how that could be done and without creating problems.
Tunnel, maybe?
Well, you could do a tunnel. That would be great, actually. No, there are obvious things. You could bus people in. We're starting a program this year with that in mind, you know, looking at the greater population. This is just a maiden effort. But you can come in and find ways to transport their stuff as well with them and come in buses. So that subtracts so many cars, you know. And I think that could grow and grow. I think a lot of people would find that, you know, it does take a kind of lunatic dedication to subject your car to that desert.
Yes.
I do it, but, you know.
And I know everybody's completely honest when the RV rental place asks them where they're going with that RV.
Well, it used to be people do it, try to undercover, and there was in rental places would, you know, were not happy if they were going. And now, you know, Nevada, all they're more than happy. It's their trade now.
Right, it's their year.
Yeah, and so that's one thing you can do. There are other things you can do. You can route the traffic somewhat differently. You know, fortunately, there's so many bright people in our community that we've had no problem finding very intelligent traffic engineers. And also, when we first got sophisticated about the actual influx off the road into the city itself, we went to people who designed systems like the Bay Bridge with its staggered. You know, we've got a lot of brain power, and it gets volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
And no one should underestimate us. And so there are ways of getting around that. But you know, as to the, you know, how big is too big, I don't know. I think the measure of it isn't quantitative. It isn't that there's some magic number with just too many people. It's really about the quality of interaction between people. You know, when that starts to then you're dealing with something like some, you know, inert mass. Then, you know, then when you get a traffic jam when it comes to social interaction, then we've lost our soul. That's what we're all about. We designed that whole city to foment creative interaction. That's the soul. That and safety are the two only things we consider. And so we've looked at how it's grown, and we've elected to grow. We'd never want to grow too fast. You know what happens when cities grow too fast. But you know, we prefer digestible bites. But that's a good bite this year. But I'm not worried. I think that quality will just, people keep coming back. You know, we sold out a year ago and they said, oh, Burning Man's over. Well, I don't know. I thought that meant a lot of people wanted to come. Call me naive.
Well, actually, I'd love to hit that point, yeah. Because everybody I know wants to know. I asked my friends, I said, what question of all the questions in the world you could ask Larry Harvey, what would you want to know? And most people said, can I get a ticket? How do I get a ticket?
Well,
so
you can't get a ticket. It's not too late to register for our last open ticket sale. If you do it right away. And that's the OMG sale, the Oh My God sale. But also, and this is what we told people last year, is that very typically, people's travel plans change very often at the last minute. And at this time of year, there are a lot of people out there we know that for sure because we have a program called the STEP program, Secure Ticket Exchange program, and if people's plans change, they can sell them through our agency and they put them for sale up for sale. We control the process and they get their money back when someone else buys their ticket. And that keeps it, that discourages scalping, which we had no problem with. Last year there was this great rumor that scalpers were causing the problem. It was 1.5% of the sales. You'd have to be a lunatic. I mean, it wouldn't be good business. Organized scalpers don't buy the tickets and then wait 8-9 months to sell them. And our people actually resell their tickets, even informally, for what they paid for them.
Right.
And that's considered ethical behavior. And people actually exhibit that behavior in the thousands. So right now, the tickets start to fall out of the trees. You'll find them for sale in various forums on the internet. They're buyable, and in many cases, they're buyable for a reasonable price. If they're coming from people in our community, it's not very likely that they'd be doubling, you know, asking for double what they paid,
right?
Or even looking to make a profit. So
you can still get them. That's good.
No, they're obtainable.
Because this is when people start to.
Well, in a way, it's like when we went to the desert from the beach and escaped the mob situation.
Yeah.
What happened with the ticket when demand exceeded supply is that last year we found that almost everybody who stuck with it and didn't give up early on and stuck with it looking got a ticket. So that selects for commitment, just like in 1990. And I don't see that. It may be you got to take a risk. You want to reserve that in your work schedule for your vacation, but you don't know if you're going to take. May have to take a risk, mm-hmm. And you might have to make a plan to go, even though you're not sure you're going to go. There is that, but we found that people who were really committed tended to get tickets and we're selling more of them this year. So,
great.
Tell them to hang in
there.
Don't
give up.
Oh no, and I wouldn't. And I caution them against buying some ticket for some ridiculous exploitative price. Mm. I don't think they need to do that at all.
There you have it. All right. Well, so back to the growth of Burning Man.
Yeah.
We've kind of covered how it's growing out on the playa and how the numbers have increased a ton and they're going to increase some more. One thing that's really fascinating is the idea of it spreading across the world with the Burning Man project. And so wanted you to talk a little bit about that. and about how much control you exert over Burning Man spin-off events happening through the rest of the world, how much you let them kind of happen on their own and run their own show.
Well, you know, our attitude towards event, and it is worldwide, you know, and not because we promoted it, because people just did it, and then we help them to, and we create a network, and in support of that. And
how big is the network?
It's all over Europe. It's the fastest growing event, Burning Man event. Done by Africa, and it's getting pretty big. South Africa, I don't know how many. It's all over.
And what kind of scale? I mean, how many Burning Man spin-off events are there in the course of a year?
I don't know. See, I don't know. It's probably, 50. Six, something like that.
All right.
It's all over. It's like pollen. It's taken by the wind. What we did is we said, well, great. We don't. We haven't franchised it. We said, okay, you have to sign a pledge that you'll follow the 10 principles, and then you're part of the network. If you're part of the network, then we'll let people know about what you're doing, and you can use our ability to, one thing that's good a center can do is it can distribute information, mm-hmm. and resources, and that's what it's good for. In our case, you're not going to produce the culture that we're looking to produce if you don't allow people who organize things a lot of autonomy. Mm. And so, this thing happened. It's interesting. You know, we didn't. No one called their event Burning Man. They tended to call it Burning. They have various names they use, but many of them are Burning something, whatever it is, and that represents their region, their community, and we didn't ask them for anything. In fact, we put them on a list so they could talk to one another, so they could talk to us, Now we want to help them. We formed the Burning Man Project to disseminate our culture globally, and we think that we could offer them consultation. As they grow, they're going to encounter, first of all, we'd learn a lot, and they'd all learn a lot from how variously situated events, how they cope with unique problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be a vibrant body of knowledge. And on the other hand, we've been down this road. This is the 27th year, and we could give them all kinds of advice about solving problems that businesses don't normally have to cope with, too, and things that businesses do have to cope with, and we can give them advice about money. We can give them administration about how to do things,
mm-hmm.
And we'll probably offer that to them and ask them to pay for the advice, and as they grow, then that would make sense. Let's have a grown-up relationship rather than... in the early going, it was almost... I don't want to offend any regionals out there, but it was almost like the kids asking for the key to the car, you know. They take the car out, and then they... And then they get a case of beer, and then they complain about their parents, and, you know, that's what I did.
Yeah.
How about you?
Right.
But now that it's growing up, when we sold out of tickets, the wave that hit our shore fell down the shingle and then inundated all these islands out there, these other events that have been done emulating us. Mm-hmm. And so now I gave a speech to our leadership conference just recently and said, well, now we're in the same boat. And it's a little like the kid who comes back. I got to be careful about patronizing people because they're very sensitive, and we only want to offer things that are due and meet. But it's like the kid coming back. Well, I have a 30-year-old, so I they come back and they say, well, you know, Dan, I got a problem with the kid. And can you give me advice? Suddenly, you know.
And you say that'll cost you.
So let's have a grown-up conversation. You know, let's have a grown-up conversation. And if it's about doing business, then let's do it in a grown-up, business-like way.
Well, without trying to get
because
any...
Because we need resources to help them, and they need, and they would need us. And if they don't want help, then they don't have to get help. I don't care. But if they find it valuable, then good.
Okay. Without trying to prompt you to give away too much free advice, from dealing with the Bureau of Land Management all these years, what would be sort of a nugget or two for people who want to start their own event?
On public land?
Yes.
Well, those people we could give a ton of advice to. You know, there's always the option of doing it on private land, which might be simpler. But wherever you do it, you're going to encounter a level of politics. We, being situated in the desert, we've dealt with the federal government. We've simultaneously dealt with the state government. We've dealt with county governments. You know, recently we've grown up. And I had thought maybe naively that we'd grow, and we did. We gained credibility. We're good economically for the region. And I thought, everything, we're all going to get along. But, you know, this debt session we're in, you know, I never thought wealth trickled down. I have a left-wing perspective, but I'll tell you, debt sure trickles down, and every county and every state government is trying to beggar their neighbor and get money from anybody around them. And suddenly we were confronting a bill before the Nevada legislature, bless its heart, that would have imposed an entertainment tax. I think they overreached on it because they included golf clubs.
They could have gotten it through otherwise.
I don't know, but they might have. And we didn't like it. And besides that, entertainment, people entertaining themselves. I mean, you're taxing them for that. there aren't any paid entertainers. But the county, the local county. And we became, we've met those challenges, you know, and we've got, it's been quite an education, you know, politically, economically, in the context of running a business that has to allocate money and certainly politically we've survived those. It turned out that we were being viewed as this big plump turkey,
cash cow,
that was walking around, you know, just waiting for someone to, you know, to go over the stuffing and, you know, carve up the white meat. We didn't fully see that coming, that we would become this enormous cash cow in the middle of, you know, straightened times. And but we've survived it. It's fine. And the Nevada legislature has adjourned for 2 years.
And gives us some time to get some work done.
It gives us some time. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got about 5 minutes before the audience Q&A. So let's see. If you guys have something to ask, if you came with a question, start getting ready and. There's a mic, which is forthcoming. And here it comes up on the side here. And on the questions, short is beautiful. No actual questions, please. No theses. All right. So before we go to questions,
yep.
I wanted to sort of do like a speed round and kind of rip through the 10 principles.
Well, they're relevant because, you know, in order to spread our culture, we years ago, at the behest of all these regional communities, they wanted some sense of values am I holding common just so they could talk to one another and do things together. And so they asked for that, and they got the 10 principles. And so we've wrapped our whole nonprofit around that. We're looking to foment our culture wherever it takes root, and even if it's not in our lineage, if it comes, whatever is us, we want to connect with it. So everything we do is going to be governed by the 10 principles, and the institution itself is actually going to be governed by an institution called the Philosophical Center. It's every intellectual's, every philosopher's dream to rule. Even Plato wanted to rule, you know. It's going to be values-based with a vengeance in a very unconventional way. Every decision we make, we're going to say, do all 10 principles exist are they present? You know, we're going to use the principles to interrogate one another. We're starting a year-long effort to promote discourse about them, and everyone seems to agree that they do seem to describe the experience. We want to use them to create more than just an ordinary institution. We want one that's saturated with the very culture it wants to create.
Well, for the benefit of the folks on the radio, perhaps we should just do the
sure.
honors. I'll just throw them out there. One, radical inclusion. Two, gifting. Three, decommodification. Four, radical self-reliance. Five, radical self-expression. Six, communal effort. Seven, civic responsibility. 8, leaving no trace. 9, participation. 10, immediacy. I like radical self-expression as a rule. That's it.
Oh, it's always popular. Civic responsibility comes in about 8, you know. But it does in society at large, so why should we be any different? And decommodification, you won't find it in a dictionary, probably.
Well, then talk about it.
Well, that simply means, that refers to the fact that we strive to create environments where where nothing is bought or sold, where there's no advertising, where there's, we did that because we found that in environments like that, gifts pass and generate themselves at enormous rates. And it leads to wonderfully collaborative and creative experiences. It actually creates a kind of magic socially. And people go on about things happening just when they had to happen as if the universe were giving them a gift. And it does create that. It's intoxicating. I wouldn't say you can live that way all the time. But I think our society has become overly commodified to the point where every value has become a commodity value and is treated that way. And you can't build culture, you can't build community that way. We spend all our lives consuming products that simulate states of being and aren't. They just make you, you know, they just pretend that if you buy this, you'll be lovable. If you buy this, you'll be creative. If you buy this, you'll have a community. If you buy, no, you'll just have a thing. So we created an environment where those things are real and created by the agency of people's actions. And we think if you go back to the regular world, you can lead a life that's more rewarding and doesn't require such awfully high levels of consumption, which we know are unsustainable. I mean, we all know this. They're not sustainable.
Which is why it's so popular among everyone that I know who's in the advertising industry.
Well,
it's true. Every time I've been up there.
Yeah, I bet they say that. They say, what?
It's the best.
Yeah.
It's like
heaven. Well, and some
people
say, my God, so they created this thing and people come out and do all the entertainment and they build the infrastructure. Why? What a sales job that's got to be. It only works if it's real. And I mean, it only works if you really embrace the values. Otherwise, you know, there isn't any secret sauce and there's no ad and there's no billboard and there's no, you know, campaign that'll that'll work in place of it. So that's what, just imagine what it'd be like if you're out, you're in a city and no one's buying or selling anything and everybody's giving things to one another. And you can't do it all the time, but it kind of makes you feel that people go out there like they're in a 68,000 member family, and it's real. It's not just sentiment, and it's not just because they're following some guru or something.
On that note, let's go to questions. As a reminder to the radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. For more about Inforum and its upcoming events, please visit us on Facebook or follow Inforum SF on Twitter. Tonight we're hosting Burning Man, the story behind Black Rock City with its founder, Larry Harvey. All right. Well, let's go to questions. Single one-part questions and
trick questions.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Larry, and thanks for stewarding a great, enriching, and fun event for all these years. My question to you is: the first year I went in 1997, Burning Man ticket was $40. Now it's about $400, and I've seen camps grow in gigantic size, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth spent on our cars and camps and food and whatnot. And I'm wondering whether this, and you know, it basically costs about $1,000 to get there. I'm wondering if this trend towards spending all this money affects the spirit of Burning Man in any way. And if there's,
I don't think it does. It's possible to go out there. The ticket price has gone up, but as you suggest, it's the least of your costs. It's possible to go out there and not spend a ton of money. You might have to rough it. Have you got a camping tent? A tent.
A tent? I usually camp in my car.
Okay, there you go. You can camp in your car, too.
I've also dropped $300 on dues before, so.
And so, you know, you can do that economically. The cost of producing the event have gone up, but then it's grown into a complex urban entity, and that costs money. And, of course, we have to pay. We're paying the federal government over $1.5 million right now just to be there.
$1.5 million.
And climbing.
Yeah. Solid.
And climbing, you know. But the government needs money, you know.
And Burning Man can do its part, then.
Yeah. We believe in civic responsibility.
Let's keep the country working. All right. Next question, please.
So I'm still a little fuzzy on the inception of the event. That first night that you were out on Baker Beach, how'd you get there? What inspired you to get there? Why were you there?
It's real simple.
And then how has your role changed?
I just called a friend and said, let's build a man, burn it on the beach. And now, where that came from, I don't know. It's kind of embarrassing. No, that's the creative process. You know, what you do, anybody who does creative things, artists particularly, but anyone can be creative in whatever they do. You know, often it's just a matter of clearing your mind and somehow listening to your soul and waiting for something to come up. Where did it come from? It's hard to say. You know, that's where creativity always begins, when you're facing what you don't know. And so, you know, that's a profound thing. But it wasn't done. It was, let's burn around the beach. That was what we did was for our purpose. That we were the same thing. And we didn't say, let's burn a man to demonstrate this or to raise funds for that. It wasn't the agency of anything. It was an end in itself. So that's a mystery. But it was a very simple proposition. And we were used to doing stuff like that. You know, Try it sometime. Find a beach, find a place and go build a man and invite a few friends and burn it. You'll have a great time.
But when
really
you do,
will, you know, and it wasn't that fancy.
Make sure you download the 10 principles.
And you can be a burning woman, it could be a burning whatever, and just make it a little taller than you so you have to look up to it. Unless something bigger than you makes you feel small, and then there's some little figure you can patronize.
Next question.
Hi, Larry. Do you see a causal link between Burning Man, which started here in the Bay Area, and the sharing economy that's arisen in the Bay Area, Zipcar, Lyft, Airbnb, those kinds of things?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a case maybe of institutions and ideas co-evolving to meet, you know, the spirit of the times, you know, to meet a more general need. We're looking at how we might systematize that in a way that leaves people nonetheless free to act and we're taking that slow. But we might wade into those waters in an organized way. Yeah. But there are a lot of, it'll take a lot of pondering, because then you get down to what makes it, you know, what makes it Burning Man culture, and is it enough to make, right now, if people sell Burning Man gear and Burning Man stuff, we have lawyers, we don't let them. And we're very jealous of the IP, not because we want to hawk stuff. We don't do that. But there might be a way that some kind of economic system in our ethos can work and maybe work in the great world. We're thinking about that. Anybody who has great ideas, they should come and talk to us about it. We want to get it right.
All right. Next question.
How's it going, Larry? You've built this incredible thing that I'm assuming, you know, going from 8 people on a beach to thousands of people in the desert, and I'm assuming you've run along a lot of roadblocks and winding paths, and it's totally not what you expected it would look like. And so I guess my question is, like, do you have a piece of advice for someone embarking on trying to either build, like, a business or something conscious, like, a community kind of thing, you know, is there something that you would say to them to keep them going and keep them following that crazy path?
Well, the first piece of advice would be don't waste time waiting around for someone to come and help you. Or I'll put that differently. You should look for help, but work with what you have to hand, and then ask people to help you. And bring in help. Now, that's what I did. Well, the first thing I did, let's burn a man. And then I called my friend, who's a better carpenter than me, and said, let's build a man. Because I'm no fool. I know what I do well. I know what other people do well. And you have to have a generous regard for people's abilities and their gifts. But I've talked to too many people say, well, you know, I just got this and I had that. And, you know, and I need to... And they do some version of it, whatever it is. Just start doing something like that. And I don't care how, and not be overcome by inward embarrassment, you know. And then get people to help. And then when you get to the point of you're talking about a business, then you've got to figure out how to deal with the money aspect. We had to go through that. And we were so backward about money, it's just ludicrous. And I mean, we were, you know, with all these artists the first big fundraiser, one of the first big fundraisers we had, I think first one at SoMarts in the city here, we had this big show, elaborate show. Everybody was working for nothing, for giving their talents. And people had worked for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it was just so we could rent a truck to take things to the desert. And I went out, and they had a cash register in the alley that led into the facility. And so it was an artist gesture. So somebody would get this sprung cash register and just put it out on the table, you know, and that was kind of a joke, the money, thing. And then people started arriving and nobody, I was involved in organizing the production. And I noticed that nobody was even at the cash register. It was just a joke, But I turned to my friends and I said, "Good Lord, I mean, we are doing this so we can do something even greater. So we need to, collect the money at the door." It took us years to figure this problem out. It doesn't need to take you years. Finally, we were out there in the desert, and we hadn't figured out how to section the city off and control access in, and so we just had a box office there in the middle of nowhere, and you went to that, and then the idea was we were so small that the only way they'd ever find the event was if somebody told them to drive 8 miles north and then 5 miles, due east. And except it was a mite lost in the middle distance itself, and it was a gate without a fence. It was an art installation, and it was a joke. And so then most of the people, they just drive past it, that way they wouldn't find it, And then when they're there, they get a lot of laughs, because there was hilarious people running it, And it was an art installation is what it was. And it wasn't until 1997 that we actually found a way to have a one point of entry so that people would, buy tickets. And, you don't have to do it the way we did it, But then we had to learn it. And at least the thing about being self-made is at least, learning lessons the hard way, well, you always remember why you're doing things, because you don't forget all the stupid things you did to gain the knowledge that you got. So don't imitate our example, just do it. Don't do it. And don't over-rationalize it, And what you might do, I hope what you want to do is something that you have a passion for, because why do it otherwise? That's the way I look at things. And believe me, people can have passions for bookkeepers. We got a very passionate bookkeeper working for us, who we pay well. That's the business side. I would suggest an exercise anybody could do. Think back to when you were a kid. When I was a kid, what was I doing? I was making up these fantasy worlds, dinosaur parks, and I'd make models and everything, except everything in it had to really work. That is, I had to be absolutely certain that that could be done. It had to be practical. It had to be a practical illusion, a practical fan, a real thing, not some fantasy. And fantastic, but not... And organizing kids around me to do theatricals, and then talking the adults into letting us get away with it. That's like dealing with the government and selecting the kids for what they were good at doing, and I was doing then what I'm doing now. So I would suggest to anybody, if they have the leisure to do it, if they have, if they're not forced by existential circumstances to do what's absolutely just expedient, to revisit those things that gave you joy and lit up your imagination. I love to quote Freud, who said that he thought there was no real happiness in life except for the realization of a childhood wish, and just don't be literal about it. Just go back and what was the feeling and what did I do and what did I what, and then try to find that. Translated into terms the world will accept, or could be made to accept.
Thank you.
Could be made to accept. I like that one.
Well, seduced into accepting, yeah.
Next question.
So I'm curious how, in the beginning, you guys helped propagate and instill the 10 principles when you guys were first starting. Because as a theme camp organizer, I'm curious how the team and I can sort of instill that in the people who can't, like, come to build days, can't contribute directly in the pre-stuff, the pre-playa-build stuff, and they can't be involved until they get to the playa. So how we can, and a lot of people are new for us this year, so how we can help also instill the 10 principles.
Well, how I'm trying to put the two halves of that question together. So how the 10 principles would motivate people? Or? Oh, well, that was in 2004 when the whole regional, well, I won't tell you too much history, but people were beginning to organize to do things, and it was just hard to do it if people didn't have a sense of commonality. And it was around the exigencies of action. They to act together, they needed to be able to think together, and they needed to be able to talk in a language where they recognized, their experience in another. So I didn't volunteer. I wrote them. I didn't volunteer. I was voluntold. And I was reminded last night by my colleague Marion that at first I balked. You know, I didn't want to institutionalize it, but they insisted. So that's why they were created. And it turns out they're actually useful. That's the test. They help people to do things. Will they do work? And they've helped a lot, and all these groups have said we will enshrine that at the center of what we're doing because it lets us do Burning Man, and so that allows us to be Burning Man.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
All right, so I'm sorry, but I think we're running up against the end of the.
It's a short one, I swear.
Can you give
give a short answer? It's not me. It's my fault. It's not their fault.
All right.
Hi, Larry. Love the party. I come back every year. My question is, we all know that Burning Man, as the population grows, it becomes higher maintenance, more expensive, tickets and otherwise, requires more law enforcement. In your honest opinion, do you feel that Burning Man's popularity will be its undoing?
No, not at all. I was saying earlier that its popularity, that people rush to attend, the numbers have gone up, but then what that led to is the growth of regional events. So what a lot of people did is, if I can't go to that one, to the big one, then I'll go to this one. And they did. So what that tells me is that you could have 50 events globally. And when you've done that, then you're affecting, well, you're affecting the world. And so I don't see it that way. We don't look at the regional efforts as competing with ours. They're us. We're them. No, I don't see that at all. I think if you had 500,000 people, I think that would be would be too much. You've actually got me to admit that there might be a too much.
500's the line. You're drawing the line.
I've drawn the line at a half a minute.
All right. All right. Thanks. Good question. The answer is no. Popularity won't be the undoing.
No.
Of Burning Man. All right. One last question.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You always have the last.
Well, yeah. It's the same question in each program, but for you, I feel like it's going to be like composing a tweet. 60 seconds. It's all you get.
Okay.
And it'll be interesting to see
how you
compress the last couple decades into this 60-second soundbite. Your 60-second idea to change the world.
Change the world? Well, that's what I'm. That's what we're trying to do. The only one I can speak with authority about is the one I know best. I think Burning Man changed the world. But I think it needs to make friends with a lot of things that are like it. Let's form a flotilla and not be vain about what we do and find things that are like us. And then we'll change the world.
Well done. Yes. Well said.
All right. Larry, thanks so much for coming tonight and talking with us and enlightening us all. And with that, this session of Inforum is now adjourned. Thanks, everybody.